Welcome, everyone, to KDVS 90.3 FM Davis. My name is Dr. Andy, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. It's a weekly radio show that comes on every Wednesday, has for the last decade or so. And on this radio show, I present to you the poets and pundits and technology prognosticators that have come to me or I've come to them. Someone who has a new book out, a new project, some enthusiasm to share with you, the listening public of KDVS. These are the people who you can look forward to hearing me interview while we listen to jazz in the background. Today, it's Jay Hoggard, one of the few vibraphonists, or as the British might say, vibraphonists, that I've introduced you to on this particular radio show. This is Jay Hoggard on vibraphone, Benny Green on piano, Marcus McLaurin on bass, and Yoron Israel on drums. It's a CD called The Little Tiger from Muse Records. Appropriately chosen, that particular record album, for this radio show where we always do something creative, unexpected, metaphorical, poetic. This afternoon, it'll be my introducing you to Laura Cherry. Laura Cherry is a San Francisco-based poet who's got a new book out called Haunts. People with names that you might have heard have been saying very nice things about this book. Laura Cherry very kindly sent me a copy here at the KDVS studios. I've so enjoyed it. Discussed it with my executive assistant, herself an award-winning poet, and we approve. So I'm very much looking forward to introducing you all to Laura Cherry. And then we may hear from another local poet, and we'll also hear a recording of poetry. It's primarily poetry on this particular Wednesday in the month of December. Here on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Here's some more vibraphone music for you to enjoy while I get Laura Cherry. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to KDVS. My name is Dr. Andy, and it's time for me to introduce you to my first guest. Her name is Laura Cherry. Laura Cherry's first full-length collection of poetry, Haunts, is now available from Cooper Dillon Books. Her chapbook, What We Planted, was awarded the 2002 Philbrick Poetry Award by the Providence Athenaeum. She is co-editor of the anthology Poem Revised from Marion Street Press. I have a copy of that book. It provides an early and a final draft, sometimes a series of early drafts, to the reader of poetry, along with interviews and reflections by the relevant poets. It's quite a good book, and again, it is called Poem Revised. That's from Marion Street Press. Laura Cherry's work has been published in a number of journals, including Forklift, Ohio, Hangman, The Vocabula Review, Newport Review, LA Review, and Naugatuck River Review. It's also appeared in the anthologies Present Tense from Calyx Press and Vocabula Bound from Vocabula Books. She received an MFA from Warren Wilson College. She lives near Boston, this says, though I think she's also spent some time in San Francisco. She works as a technical writer. And I'm pleased to welcome her to the program. Laura Cherry, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Hi, Andy. Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Great to have you here. Well, as I mentioned in my pre-introduction, I've been reading your new book, Haunts, sharing it with another poet whose work I respect and enjoy. And we've so enjoyed your book. She's my executive assistant. She's an award-winning poet herself, and she's a very difficult person to please. Sometimes I show her the work of people who I'm going to interview, and she'll shrug politely. But she really loves this book, Haunts.
That's great.
So I thought I'd mention that. And I'll mention later some of the other folks who have said kind things about your first full-length collection. But I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit of the story of how this book came to be, because it's not an easy thing to come out with a full-length collection of poetry these days.
No, this book has been a long time in the making, at least 15 years in some cases, in the case of certain individual poems, even more. So I've been working on the manuscript for quite some time, and eventually I found it coalescing into what felt to me like a coherent manuscript, especially when I sort of discovered the title, Haunts, which covers so many different, many of the different sort of obsessions or themes that go on in the book. And once I did that, it all kind of came together, and then I found this wonderful publisher, Cooper Dillon, out of San Diego, and it's just been great. It just kind of went from there.
When I was an undergraduate at Boston University in the city of Boston, I found myself haunted by history somewhat, with all the places in say downtown Boston near Park Street or in Cambridge that I would visit, and a lot of it is a literary history as well as an important say revolutionary history. And I'm wondering if you could tell me and listeners a little bit about how is it that Haunts and Hauntings works as a theme through your new book.
Well, Haunts definitely for me has the meaning of places in terms of the places that you haunt, your hangouts, that kind of thing. So
right.
So places in more in terms of a personal history rather than a more global or literary history, really. Haunts also has the meaning of ghosts. So there are a number of ghostly figures in the book of various degrees of importance. And haunts is also obviously a verb, a memory that haunts you, or
right.
A figure, something you read in the paper. So all of these are kind of interwoven throughout the book, and none of them, I would say, takes preeminence. They're kind of thread through each of the sections.
And I guess that hauntedness that you spoke of, the third kind of being, say, haunted by an image or a happenstance, and I noticed that in a number of poems, that sense in your book, that paying attention to that is in part the responsibility and the work of a poet who is more often more reflective, more empathic, has a greater and more finely tuned memory, especially memory of feelings, memory of specific images. And much of that comes up in your poetry. One gets the sense that you've been paying close attention.
That's also the joy and the gift, I think, that writing poetry gives to the poet, is that it captures something that might otherwise just slip by, a moment or something that we read, something that might catch us for a second, but then if we don't get it down somehow, it could just slip into the sort of morass of, you know, memories that we never recall before. But if it's captured in a poem, then you've got it forever, and you always can remember what that felt like. And that, of course, underscores that keeps the haunting alive, I suppose. So in a sense, I guess I'm haunting myself with these things.
Right, right. That the ghost keeps being invited back.
Mm-hmm.
For another conversation, remember that
right.
time, that sort of thing.
Right, exactly.
If you're just joining us, Laura Cherry is my guest, and we're talking about her new book, Haunts, and it's just been published by Cooper Dillon Press. It's a beautiful book, and you can find it many places, including by visiting the website lauracherrypoetry.com. Let's take a brief detour into technology for a moment, Laura. I very much like your website. It's simple. It has some poems, a bio, a picture of you and your book. And I'm wondering how you approach technology as a poet, and if either you, your friends, or your publisher has been telling you to start thinking about building a platform using a variety of social networking technologies such as Facebook and Twitter to get the word out about your new project and about yourself as a poet and as a writer of prose about poetry.
Well, no one's particularly been pushing me towards that, but I feel that it's just kind of all around us now, and it's the direction that I see everything going in. I mean, I am a technical writer for a software company, so
right.
in my professional life, I definitely have that that sense that even for businesses and corporations, this social networking piece, everyone's trying to figure out how to use it. And as I've seen friends get published and promote their books, I see them using more and more social networking, especially Facebook. And so when my book came out, it was a more or less natural thing to promote it on Facebook. I belong to a number of listservs that I've been participating in for years. Suddenly those became venues for publicity, whereas before, I had anything to promote, they were primarily social or finding out information, and suddenly I was the one providing information. So I would say, in fact, that the majority of the publicity for my book, especially since I work with a small press, has been through venues like these, and that the sales that they've had have come through efforts like that rather than more traditional kinds of promotional efforts like advertising, ads in magazines or what have you.
And certainly poets, I guess, need to push their work in part through their appearances and those poetry readings that are kind of representations of the hauntedness that one might find in a book of poetry. Sometimes poetry readings at an actual haunt. There are certainly a lot of great bookstores in Boston, including a few on Massachusetts Avenue and Newbury Lane, where I saw poetry readings back in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And do you, in terms of your own haunts, are there bookstores in your neighborhood where people know your name and where you've been looking forward or have already presented this book to friends and admirers?
Well, there are a few reading series that I attend off and on and know the moderators to a certain extent. And so I've got a couple of readings set up in the new year, not necessarily at bookstores, but sometimes either at galleries or, other venues like that. And also through the social networking channels, I've been able to find reading series in Rhode Island and one in New York. And so I'll be doing a little mini East Coast reading tour in the new year, probably one reading a month, one or two a month for a while to get the book out there and hopefully spread the word and to celebrate the fact that this is finally there, and as opposed to just being in my manuscript for so long.
Right, your beloved manuscript.
Great.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we return, Laura Cherry, I hope that we can entice you to read a poem from your new book, Haunts.
Sure.
All right. You're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Dr. Andy, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. This is Dr. Andy with an important message about the Linux Users Group of Davis. The Linux Users Group of Davis, or LUGOD, is a 501c7 nonprofit computer club serving the Sacramento region, consisting of nearly 450 people who share an interest in the Linux operating system, free and open source software, and other related topics, both technical and non-technical. The goals of LUGOD are to advocate for the use of Linux and open source software, to educate the community on the software alternatives, and to support and provide a social network for local Linux users. LUGOD holds regular meetings twice a month on the first Tuesday of each month. They hold a social gathering at a local restaurant or cafe, and on the third Monday of each month, they meet at the Davis Public Library, which just reopened yesterday, to listen to informative presentations by guest speakers. For instance, on Monday, December 20th, 2010, at 7 o'clock, Oliver Kralos, a project scientist from the Department of Geology at the University of California, Davis, will be giving a talk called 3D Display, 3D Interaction, 3D Capture, and Off-Label Uses of Community Hardware, parentheses, or, colon, How to Become an Internet Celebrity in 3 Easy Steps. You might have heard or read about some of the work of Oliver Kralos and the recent offerings from Microsoft, more specifically, Microsoft's Kinect, which I think you can use with the Xbox. Anyway, it's the Linux Users Group of Davis. If you'd like to find out more, visit their website at lugod.org. That's LUGOD.org. Laura Cherry is my guest this afternoon on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Here's what Steffi Weisbird, who wrote the book The Wind-Up Gods, says about Laura Cherry and her new book, Haunts. At once caffeinated and considered, razor-sharp, smart, and unsentimentally sweet, Laura Cherry navigates urban landscapes, childbearing, stories of childhood, and modest beginnings, finding resonance and beguiling surprises in the rhythms of ordinary life. Like the three-year-old in one poem, Cherry's crisp language, quote, rockets through the room, firm and loud in its skin. Haunts is moving, cathartic, gossipy, humorous, and always fascinating. It's a new book by Laura Cherry, and it's called Haunts. available from Cooper Dillon Books. Laura Cherry is my guest this afternoon. So, Laura, what poem would you like to share with listeners of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour this afternoon?
Well, I think I'd like to read one from the first section, which is, it's generally the most impersonal section in the book, more about kind of the riches of the world that are sort of borne in on us rather than, you know, more pieces from my own life specifically, or just the joy of language, this first book, this first section. So the poem I'd like to read is actually called I Demand an Explanation, which sounds personal, but the poem is just more of a playful celebration of language, I think, than anything else.
Great.
I Demand an Explanation. Has a Maine lobster got your tongue, or has a Charlie Chaplin film festival silenced you for months? Surely your next move will be a 21 bagpipe apology, with you in a hot air balloon high above reproach, flaunting your star-spangled manner. Might you fling 1,000 stuffed bears from a skyscraper, hoping I'm in New York? How about shooting a murky pearl at me from a silver pistol? Mail me your mother. Stir-fry an armadillo. Trim all the hedges in the yard to spell my name. Hang in my doorway in gravity boots and refuse to move until I forgive you. I forgive you.
That's wonderful. It's called I Demand an Explanation. When you started with, and it's a very nice poem. I love the collection of images that you have here, especially shooting a murky pearl at me from a silver pistol. It makes me almost think of werewolves. But
right.
But when the poem begins with a Maine lobster, you as a Boston poet, I couldn't help but also think of Robert Lowell. And I'm wondering if you're haunted at all by Robert Lowell or perhaps Sylvia Plath or some other New England poet, or if the influences that one might hear in your new book haunts come from further away.
No, I think absolutely Robert Lowell and Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton, that mm-hmm. whole group of confessional poets that knew one another and we're here briefly together in the same area for a time. I think it's hard to get away from that kind of influence, especially for the kind of, if one's writing anything about one's own life.
Right.
And what compels me most, I think, is the sense of urgency and drama that really underlies even the quietest life. I mean, I live a pretty quiet suburban life, and yet you just scratch the surface of, you know, anywhere you look, and there's this kind of molten lava underneath. And I think especially, well, all of them really had a way of digging into that and allowing it to erupt. And I think my poetry is quieter than that, but definitely that's a vein that runs through it, is that, you know, that lava, that that excitement, that anywhere you dig, you're going to find a surprise, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that with those quiet eruptions, I think that would be perhaps a more accurate way of describing several of your poems. Whereas Lowell, Plath, and Sexton, each one of them could delve into the R-rated aspects of life, especially violence. And
right.
And one sees much less of that in your book, Haunts.
True, though it does approach the at least PG-13 towards the end when I discuss the life of a Long Island teenager.
right.
So that's where things go off the rails a little bit.
Absolutely. Tell me a little bit about your lengthy preparation to finish this book. You had mentioned earlier that you've been working on the manuscript for a number of years. But in terms of your own formal training, I know that you earned an MFA from Warren Wilson College, which seems to be one of the most popular and favorite of low residency MFAs, of people who have come on this radio show, really seems to be increasingly important for important poets. And so I'm curious to know what your impressions of Warren Wilson are. And then other work that you've done, either as a technical writer or as an undergraduate or whatever the case may be, to prepare yourself to be a poet.
Well, I loved Warren Wilson. It was absolutely, completely the foundation of you know, all the writing that I've been able to do has, I mean, of course I was a writer before I attended there, but it solidified so much for me. The supervisors, the professors there are wonderful. It's a great community, basically completely free of competition, as far as I can tell, between the students, which,
that's
from
great.
What I hear, is fairly rare in a graduate writing program. And it has fostered a wonderful community also of alumni who keep in touch and connect across the miles, which with a low residency program, that kind of connection is really important while you're in the program, because no one actually, you know, because people are scattered all over between the residencies.
Right.
To keep any kind of continuity, you need to be in touch by email and other means like that. So that was all really important. But what I learned there in the residencies and from the supervisors, but also just learning to be part of a community that trusts each other and gets feedback from each other, and I still do that a lot with the friends that I made in the program. And the manuscript itself is somewhat based, the skeleton of it is, it comes from the thesis, from my MFA thesis, which I think is, you know, somewhat common for a first book, but it has blossomed a little bit since then. It's been restructured and retitled, and you know, poems have been switched out. And but I know that I wouldn't have this book if it hadn't been for that program. And I also want to mention that a number of these poems, particularly from the final section, the more narrative-type poems, I wrote when I was working with my supervisor, Steve Orlin, who very recently passed away after a short illness. And he's a great loss to the community, the Warren Wilson community specifically, and just the world of poetry in general. It was a wonderful, generous soul and a great poet. So I just want to mention my gratitude towards him, and please check out his work if you're listening, because he was a terrific, terrific poet.
Tell us how to spell his last name.
Steve Orlin, O-R-L-E-N.
Great, Steve Orlin. I'm sorry for your loss. I was going to ask you about your heroes and mentors. Could you say a little bit more about some of the ways that Steve Orlin in particular was helpful to you?
Steve himself had a very expansive way of both writing and teaching, so that he would just kind of offer up his time and energy and give you whatever he had. And that kind of flowed both into his work and, I think, into the work of the students that that were lucky enough to study with him. And in my case, the types of poems that Steve wrote were somewhat narrative, sprawling, kind of funny. And so I tapped into a similar vein for myself when I started writing about high school and all the absurd, you know, slightly off-color stories that linger. Suddenly I found transforming themselves into poems, and that was a great gift. That was a really wonderful gift that Steve gave me.
Excellent. Well, I brought this up while you were just telling us about him, so I'll tell listeners at home that Steve Orlin was the author of 2 chapbooks and 4 collections of poetry, Permission to Speak, A Place at the Table, The Bridge of Sighs, and Kisses. He received awards from the National Endowment for the Arts and the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, as well as the George Dillon Memorial Award from Poetry Magazine. And Tony Hoagland also said some nice things about him on the versedaily.org site for the late Steve Orlin. Laura Cherry, let's hear another poem from your book, Haunts.
Sure. Well, since we were just talking about this, I'll read one of those poems that I've been referring to. This one is called The Nurse and the Principal. Mr. Carpenter to the nurse's office was the secret faculty code for a bomb threat, an announcement that interrupted class and paused and repeated. And we hooted and whistled at this raunchy development, the nurse and the principal going at it in the closet with the asthma medications, alcohol swabs, and blood pressure cuff, while our French teacher ticked over to the door in her 3-inch heels and stuck her pretty neck out, looking left and right. These were the expert precautions. Look both ways down the hall to find the bomb. And we were quiet in the odd static of the moment until she turned, snapped her fingers, and started warbling transitive verbs. But after school, our English teacher told some of us what it meant, as teachers whisper everywhere to their favorite few, so that later, in the dark, instead of picturing Mr. C, suit pants pooled at his ankles, bending the nurse over her porcelain sink to the delighted cheers of the intercom, the mascots, pets, and geeks, privileged with insider status, fell asleep seeing purple and gold pennants in flames, blown bits of brick and flesh, glass beakers just bursting to sing.
Oh, it's a beautiful poem about an explosion. One finds so few beautiful poems about explosions.
Thank you.
That was very nice. I was thinking of one that I learned about when I lived in Boston by Philip Larkin, which I think was called The Explosion.
Oh, yes, that wonderful poem about the miners. That's an incredibly moving poem.
Absolutely. And if you don't mind, do you have a little extra time?
Sure.
I thought we'd just take a quick break, and because I have it right here, I thought I'd share it with people, because I haven't done anything on Philip Larkin in a while. Ladies and gentlemen, this poem is called The Explosion. It's by Philip Larkin, who lived from, I believe, 1922 to 1985. He was a British poet. The Explosion. On the day of the explosion, shadows pointed toward the pit head. In the sun, the slag heap slept. Down the lane came men in pit boots, coughing oath-edged talk and pipe smoke, shouldering off the freshened silence. One chased after rabbits, lost them, came back with a nest of lark's eggs, showed them, lodged them in the grasses. So they passed in beards and moleskins, fathers, brothers, nicknames, laughter, through the tall gates standing open. At noon, there came a tremor. Cows stopped chewing for a second. Sun scarfed as in a heat haze, dimmed. The dead go on before us. They are sitting in God's house in comfort. We shall see them face to face. Plain as lettering in the chapels, it was said, and for a second, wives saw men of the explosion, larger than in life they managed, gold as on a coin, or walking somehow from the sun towards them, one showing the eggs unbroken. That was the poem, The Explosion, by Philip Larkin. It's from his 1974 book, High Windows. We're chatting with Laura Cherry this afternoon and talking about her new book, Haunts. We're going to take a quick musical break. I have a public service announcement to share. And then we'll be back to hear one more poem by Laura Cherry. My name is Dr. Andy, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Thank you. This is Dr. Andy with an important message. Every night, more than 5 million Californians go to bed hungry. For the past 40 years, the Food Bank of Yolo County has worked to feed needy residents throughout the county that calls Davis, Woodland, and Winters its home. Beginning as an all-volunteer effort, the food bank has grown into a major resource center distributing nutritious food to nearly 20,000 people every month. Due to the ongoing economic crisis, the number of hungry people continues to grow daily. The need for volunteers, donations, and advocates has never been greater. Learn about how you can join the fight against hunger by visiting www.foodbankyc.org. A public service message from the Food Bank of Yolo County and KDVS. Later on in the program, we'll hear a few recorded poems. Right now, we're enjoying the music of Jay Hoggard. This is from his CD, The Little Tiger. This particular track is called Mystic Winds, Tropic Breezes. We're also enjoying the poetry of Laura Cherry this afternoon. She's written a brand new book. It's called Haunts. It's now available from Cooper Dillon Books. You can also find out more about this book by going to Laura Cherry's website, which is lauracherrypoetry.com. Laura Cherry, before we hear your final poem of this particular appearance on the radio show, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how you're able to balance your work as a technical writer as with your work as a poet. Do you write poems in the evenings and do technical work all day?
Well, I find that both types of writing are really necessary to me. The technical writing, obviously, to make a living.
Right.
And the poetry, as I said, to kind of keep the other parts of my brain and heart alive to the non-workaday aspects of the world. Mostly, actually, when I'm in a writing mode, I tend to think about writing in the morning, and I have a commute by bus and train to work, and especially if I'm reading books of poetry by other people, that kind of gets me going, and I can start working on lines and things during my commute, actually, and there's a stretch of Main Street in Cambridge that I walk every day from the subway to work that I think of as kind of my poetry stretch. I realized just today, actually, because oftentimes if I've been thinking about poems during my commute, I'll stop somewhere on the way and start writing before I actually get into the office, and you know, everything turns into meetings and whatnot.
Right.
So and then once I get the lines down, then I can kind of work on it anytime, any place. It's the first spark, getting that, you know, capturing that. That's the really crucial piece that has to be done more carefully and tended, you know, to make sure it turns into a flame.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a very good way to put it. I remember that in your new book, Haunts, you have written one particular poem after Wallace Stevens. And Stevens was someone else, of course, who worked on poems on his commute, often walking to work and having the rhythm of those walks be a part of the poem that he would sometimes dictate to his secretary when finally he arrived and had what he had written memorized so that he could look over it again, that something that she had typed up for him during his lunch break when working as an executive at a a big insurance company in Hartford, Connecticut.
Right. Yes, I'm minus the secretary myself.
It's too bad that more poets don't have secretaries. Think about how much more productive we would be.
That's true.
I don't know if we'd be more creative, but certainly more productive. Well, wonderful. I'd love to hear one last poem from your book, Haunts. Do you have a third there that you could share with us?
Yes. I'd like to read one from a sequence that I wrote about my daughter, both before and after her birth. And the one that I'd like to read is called Lila. Lila. Greek for the lily. Arabic for night. Diminutive of Delilah. My care won't bring us luck. My luck won't bring us peace. You're the string around my finger. Remember this. It comes at 19 weeks, just before the bombs. Your little drum protest with its audience of one. I hold my plans unclenched. Admire the lizard of your spine, the wagging tongue of your heart. Your starfish hand in the picture, my finest hope to date.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Such nice poems throughout the book. So let me endorse it as well. You've got some important people endorsing this book on the back cover. But the book we've been talking about is Haunts. It's by Laura Cherry. She's been my guest this afternoon on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Laura, thanks so much for sending a copy of this book and making some time this afternoon to tell my readers about the good work that you've been doing on behalf of poetry.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Andy.
Same here. Take care.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS, 90.3 FM in Davis. And now, back to the vibraphones. KDVS, 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Andy Jones, and you're listening to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. I'm a big advocate for local poetry readings. You know, you can see a reading just about every Monday of the year at the Sacramento Poetry Center. Google Sacramento Poetry or visit sacramentopoetrycenter.org to find out more about the incredible reading series run by a number of poets who have appeared on this program. And then twice a month here in the city of Davis, as you can find out at poetryindavis.com. People enjoy the Poetry Night reading series. The next one is coming up a week from tomorrow. That is something like the 16th, I think, of December. We'll see if anyone's left here in this fair city of Davis. On the 16th, Thursday, a week from tomorrow, at the John Atsoulis Gallery, there will be a reading by a poet who I first discovered when she appeared on this radio show. Her name is Inara Gard, and she, like Laura Cherry, spent a long time in Boston But now Inara Gard has moved to Sacramento. She'll be giving her first, one of her first major readings in the area and her first big reading in the city of Davis. She'll be joined by Bill Gaynor. Bill Gaynor's been an important figure on the local poetry scene for more than a decade. He is a Foothills poet who has also been an MC like myself and therefore well-versed, if you'll pardon the pun, at promoting the poetry of other people, as we try to do every week on this particular radio show. We were talking about Robert Lowell with Laura Cherry earlier, and I thought we might hear a couple of poems spoken by the great Boston Brahmin poet himself. The first one, which has a geographical connection to it, as you'll see, is Robert Lowell tells the story of visiting a particular location. The first poem that we'll hear is called The Old Flame. Here, on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour, the next voice you hear will be that of the Glasscock Poetry Award-winning poet, Robert Lowell.
My old flame, my wife, remember our lists of birds? One morning last summer, I drove by our house in Maine. It was still on top of its hill. Now a red ear of Indian maize was splashed on the door. Old Glory, with 13 stars hung on a pole. The clapboard was old red schoolhouse red. Inside, a new landlord, a new wife, a new broom. Atlantic seaboard, antique shop, pewter, and plunder shone in each room. A new frontier. This is in the Kennedy days. No running next door now to phone the sheriff for his taxi to Bath and the state liquor store. I'm afraid we went there often. 20 miles. Health to the new people. Health to their flag. To their old, restored house on the hill. Everything had been swept bare, furnished, garnished, and aired. Everything's changed for the best. How quivering and fierce we were, there snowbound together, simmering like wasps in our tent of books. Poor ghost, old love, speak with your old voice, a flaming insight that kept us awake all night. In one bed and apart, we heard the plow groaning uphill, a red light, then a blue, as it tossed off the snow to the side of the road.
That was Robert Lowell that we just heard. Let's hear another Robert Lowell poem. This one of his most famous, and one that I've taught in Introduction to Poetry, perhaps a half dozen times here at the University of California at Davis, Robert Lowell's poem, Skunk Hour.
Nautilus Island's hermit heiress still lives through winter in her Spartan cottage. Her sheep still graze above the sea. Her son's a bishop. Her farmer is first selectman in our village. She's in her dotage. Thirsting for the hierarchic privacy of Queen Victoria's century, she buys up all the eyesores facing her shore and lets them fall. The season's ill. We've lost our summer millionaire who seemed to leap from an L.L. Bean catalog. His nine-knot yawl was auctioned off to lobstermen. A red fox stain covers Blue Hill. And now our fairy decorator brightens his shop for fall. His fish nets filled with orange cork. Orange is cobbler's bench and all. There is no money in his work. He'd rather marry. One dark night, my Tudor Ford climbed the hill skull. I watched for love cars. Lights turned down, they lay together hull to hull with the graveyard shelves on the town. My mind's not right. A car radio bleats, love, oh careless love. I hear my ill spirit sob in each blood cell as if my hand were at its throat. I myself am hell. Nobody's here. Only skunks that search in the moonlight for a bite to eat. They marched on their souls up Main Street. White stripes, moonstruck eyes, red fire, under the chalk, dry and spire of the Trinitarian Church. I stand on top of our back steps and breathe the rich air. A mother skunk with her column of kittens swills the garbage pail. She jabs her wedge head in a cup of sour cream, drops her ostrich tail, and will not scare.
Let's hear something completely different now. We've had our mind and our poetry firmly in New England for this hour. So let's share with you just a little bit of San Francisco poetry. Here's one by Lawrence Ferlinghetti. It's called Underwear. This poem, neither rated R nor PG-13, might be construed as some as a rated PG poem. So if there are children nearby, you may want to turn up the radio. And now, Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Underwear. That's a serious subject, underwear. I didn't get much sleep last night thinking about underwear. Have you ever stopped to consider underwear in the abstract? When you really dig into it, some shocking problems are raised. Underwear is something we all have to deal with. Everyone wears some kind of underwear. Even Indians wear underwear. Even Cubans wear underwear. The Pope wears underwear, I hope. The governor of Louisiana wears underwear. I saw him on TV. He must have had tight underwear. He squirmed a lot. Underwear can really get you in a bind. You've seen the underwear ads for men and women, so alike but so different. Women's underwear holds things up, men's underwear holds things down. Or vice versa. Underwear is one thing men and women have in common. Underwear is all we have between us in the end. You've seen the three-color pictures with crotches and circles to show the areas of extra strength. And three-way stretch, promising full freedom of action. Don't be deceived. It's all based on a two-party system, which doesn't allow much freedom of choice the way things are set up. America in its underwear struggles through the night. Underwear controls everything in the end. Take foundation garments, for instance. They're really fascist forms of underground government, making people believe something but the truth, telling you what you can or can't do. Did you ever try to get around a girdle? Perhaps nonviolent action is the only answer. Did Gandhi wear a girdle? Did Lady Macbeth wear a girdle? Was that why Macbeth murdered sleep? And that spot she was always rubbing, was it really in her underwear? Modern Anglo-Saxon ladies must have huge guilt complexes. Always washing and washing and washing out damn spot. Underwear with spots, very suspicious. Underwear with bulges, very shocking. Underwear on clothesline, a great flag of freedom. Someone has escaped his underwear, maybe naked somewhere. Help! But don't worry. Everybody's still hung up in it. There won't be no real revolution. And poetry's still the underwear of the soul. And underwear still covering a multitude of faults in the geological sense. Strange sedimentary stones, inscrutable cracks. If I were you, I'd keep aside an oversized pair of winter underwear. Do not go naked into that good night. And in the meantime, keep calm and warm and dry. No use stirring yourselves up prematurely over nothing. Move forward with dignity and invest. Don't get emotional, and death shall have no dominion. There's plenty of time, my darling. Are we not still young and easy? Don't shout.
That was Lawrence Ferlinghetti telling us some of his thoughts about underwear. Well, I'd like to thank you for tuning in this afternoon to Dr. Randy's Poetry and Technology Hour. I'd especially like to thank my guest, Laura Cherry, the Boston-based poet whose new book is called Haunts. And that book can be found on the website of Cooper Dillon Books, as well as at lauracherrypoetry.com. Jess has been preparing some fantastic music to share with you all this afternoon. This evening, I guess. We're up to the evening now. 6 o'clock on a winter's night means it's well past dark and time for you to tune in to some groovy music. So keep it right here at KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. I'll be back next week for another edition of this show, and at that time I'll tell you more about Anara Gard and Bill Gaynor, both of them reading a week from tomorrow at the John Nitzulis Gallery here in the city of Davis. Details available at poetryanddavis.com. I'll give you a hint, there's a website for this radio show. I haven't really launched it yet, but it's just poetrytechnology.com. I welcome your feedback, and I welcome your listenership. Here, on everybody's favorite poetry and technology radio show, you've been listening to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. See you next week.